These are unusual times, but I'm going to try to dive into the parsha and give us a little bit of continuity. Picking up from last week, which I'll admit feels like it was more than a month ago. This week's parsha is Vayakel Bekudei, double parsha. As I mentioned last week, many rabbis are incredibly grateful when we have Vayakel Bekudei as a double parsha, because it is incredibly hard to find material often to speak about, because Vayakel Bekudei is almost a verbatim repeat of Truma Tetzava, which we read just 3 weeks ago. It is, again, almost to the word, a repetition of the construction of the Mishkan. And, oh, did I do something? Oh, Jesse, you're sharing your screen if you want to do that. Okay. You stop doing that. It is about the construction of the Mikdash, the building of the Mishkan. It is about the clothes of the Kohanim. And I do want to put one pasuk under pressure in particular, but as usually we do in this shiur, we summarize an overview of the parasha in its entirety, and then we really hone in on one particular pasuk. And when it gets to that pasuk, I'll share my screen with you and we'll have a look at that particular context. So to start from a step back, for those of you who have a chumash in front of you, you'll be able to navigate as we go through. Otherwise, I'm happy just to say it outside. The parsha begins, and I should note that this is a parsha which is fond to me, particularly in the context of this shul, that it is the week that I came to try out Parsha Vayakel 1 year ago. If we were in shul this Shabbos, I would think about reusing that drasha to see if anybody notices, and see if maybe you rehire me or something. But I'll have to leave that for next year. We'll see how that goes. The assembling of the Jewish people, which I spoke about last year, in the difference between an adah, an edah, and a kehillah, v'yakel Moshe kol adat b'nei Yisrael, Moses did something to the people. He shifted them from an edah to kehillah, and Rabbi Sachs has a fascinating piece in Covenant Conversation this week on the difference between a congregation and a crowd, which of course is very apt for us being a congregation who cannot congregate and cannot crowd. But something shifts at this moment. And in the larger perspective, if we take the rabbinic view that every single letter in the Torah is not an excess, it has a purpose and a function, we have a big problem on our hands. And what is the problem? I'm happy to take your views. You can unmute yourself and chime in. What's the problem? If every letter is important in the Torah, what's the problem with this week's parsha?
Right, right.
Yes, Saul. Okay, I'll tell you how. Unmute you yourself and chime in if you want. The problem is, this week's parsha, the whole thing. That's the problem in the first pasuk. The whole parsha is a problem because we just said if every letter has to have a function, every word has to have a purpose, why are we repeating everything we just read 3 weeks ago? And it's true that in Truma Tetzava, the description of the building of the Mishkan was a directive. It was God telling Moshe, this is how it ought to be built. And now we're being told not how it ought to be built, but a description of it being built. But it still seems a little redundant to me. And Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein has a reading of this, which I think we can adapt to our circumstance this evening, but it has broader applications as well. Rav Lichtenstein suggested a parable. You imagine a young couple get engaged. It's a beautiful simcha. It's a celebration. And for those of you who either got engaged recently or have friends or family who got engaged recently, a very exciting moment comes when the happy couple go to Bed Bath & Beyond and they get that little clicky thing. And you get to go around putting everything on your registry. I can see Mark is smiling there. I guess you've seen that recently. and what dishes you want, and you negotiate over a $300 rice cooker that one of you thinks you're going to use and the other one says is a ridiculous waste of money. You're designing a house. You're building your life. You've never had to do that before. You've never had the chance to do that before. And it's a moment of excitement. And that's what 3 weeks ago was. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was describing to Moshe and through him to the Jewish people what the house of worship would look like, where the menorah would go, where the shulchan would go, where the Aron Kodesh would go, what is in the Aron Kodesh, what the curtains would look like, what the kruvim would look like, what the kohanim would look like. It was filling sacred space, and it was exciting, it was charged, it was romantic, it was a moment of excitement. And then last week, tragedy fell. The Jewish people betrayed God. And Rav Lichtenstein expresses, imagine that during an engagement, everything falls apart. And one betrays the other, or for circumstances beyond their control, the dream is shattered. And everything falls by the wayside. And then 3 years later, they re-meet this couple and they decide that they're going to get married in the end and re-heal that bond. Going to Bed Bath & Beyond in Rav Lichtenstein's vision is less exciting at that moment. You don't debate over which kind of plate you're going to have. You're just grateful to have the relationship. You're grateful to re-heal that bond. And, you know, whatever plate, let's get the plates, let's get the cutlery. It's really not the end of the world. The most important thing is the relationship, because it can't ever fully be that same excitement as it is initially. And Rav Lichtenstein suggested that the entire repetition of Vayakal Pekudei is a Kodesh Baruch Hu stressing to the people that actually we can rebuild, that this is going to be just as exciting. And we're going to go through every vessel, every curtain, every thread, every gem, every placement, every garment, to show that this relationship, though it was fractured last week, though you betrayed me, though at the moment of revelation you turned your back on me, we're going to remake this relationship and we're going to come back together. And Rav Lichtenstein at that time suggested this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying that our relationship with him is not like it is with other people. And sometimes we have moments in human relationships that do scar and really stop us from being the same. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu lets us rejoin him. But I think the truth is we could associate that with us today as well, that right now, and I don't know about all of you, but right now it is hard to imagine us getting back to normal. This is such a fissure in normal lives. Everything has fallen apart. We're not in buildings. We're not congregating. We're not seeing each other. Shabbat is going to be a hollow vacuum instead of a filled time. Pesach for many as something tragic. To avoid. I was on a call earlier today with rabbis when one rabbi asked, what happens if we just decide not to declare Rosh Chodesh? Can we just decide as a people that it's not going to be Pesach? Rav Schechter disagreed with that possibility. Those of you who I built your hope up for a moment, I apologize. But there is this unease, this eagerness to not face regular Jewish life in this setting. And the hope is that our Truma and Tetzave excitement, the enthusiasm that we had just 3 weeks ago, though of course there are jitters before Chag always about the preparation and making sure we've covered all our bases, and don't worry, Pesach communication is going to be coming in very short order with how to sell your chametz and how to prepare for Pesach. But we were excited, and now we are in a state of floating unease. And the hope is that Vayakal Pekudei will come. That we're Pekudei will come and we will jump right back into Jewish life. We'll rebuild our sacred space. Not just as it was, maybe even closer, even better, and actually build. So that's how I think we can see the overview of this mention here that it is not an excess, it is not a redundancy. In over Shabbat, if you take the opportunity to read through the parasha, it's going to be long. And part of you might feel, you told me a couple weeks ago, that every redundant sentence should remind you that actually it is a summons that things can heal, that fissures, though they happen, can be re-sown. And as we persevere through this time. So that's an overview, broadly speaking, of the repetition. But there are things along the way that I want to draw our attention to. What is it, people? What does he tell them first? Somebody is going to have to be the first to jump in. If you don't know, that's fine. But if you know, jump in. What is the Kolad Bnei Israel? Moshe assembles the entire Jewish people with what purpose? To tell them something critical. Give me a second. There's a lot of background noise here. I apologize. I've got two baby monitors and a heater on, so I feel like I'm in an airliner. Moshe assembles the people with a particular purpose, and he says to them, Eila hadvarim asher tziva Hashem lasot utam, these are the things that God commanded you to do, and then he tells them what they're not to do. Sheshit yamim ta'aseh melacha, for 6 days you will do work, v'yom hashvi yelechem kodesh shabbat shabbaton l'Hashem, for the seventh day you shall not, you shall keep Shabbat. And this is the second time that Shabbat is put in conjunction with the Mishkan. Mm-hmm. And this is precisely how we learn which malachot are forbidden in the Mishkan. On Shabbat, all 39 malachot that contribute to the building of the Mishkan are prohibited on Shabbat, and that conjunction is played out again. But there is a subtle but important difference. And the difference is, in Parshat Ki Tisa, which concluded the building of the Mishkan V'yakal B'kudah of Truma Tetzaveh, can I just check for a moment? Is anybody there?
Yes.
Yeah. Someone give me a sound.
Hello.
Here, I'm here.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, now you're there. Now you're there. Okay, good. It suddenly looked like my computer froze.
Present.
Did it freeze at any point, or was it continuous?
Yes, it freezes every so often.
Oh, that's not good. Hold on.
It had stated that you have a low bandwidth, I'm sorry to say.
I mean, that happens to be true, but...
Don't take it personally.
Mark, can you boost Rabbi Lerner's internet service from where you're at?
Sure, let me call the satellite.
Mark, you can do everything.
Let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm obviously going to have to find a better solution for this.
Just give us the frequency of your baby monitor.
Oh, that could be the issue. Is that better?
We'll see.
Any better?
Yes.
All right, well, I guess I'll give a floating share on the computer. Okay, so there's a subtle difference. Say again.
Try Cunningham Park.
What?
Forget it.
I've already forgotten it. Okay. So there is a subtle difference between the first instantiation of the Mishkan and Shabbat and this time. The first time that it's mentioned, we have the building of the Mishkan, and then at the very end, we're told, and you have to keep Shabbat. This time, when Moshe gathers the people, and he issues the directives to them, and they begin building, he says to them, these are the things you have to do. First, don't do anything on Shabbos, and then build a Mishkan. And a number of the commentators are perplexed. If we are giving a repetition with the powerful message that we noted a moment ago, that this repetition is to instantiate the sense of healing, that after the fissure, after the break of last week, we can repeat, why are there any changes? Why is Shabbat put up front? Any guesses why Shabbat would be put up front the second time, but at the end the first time?
First time is Shamar, second time is Zachar.
Okay, fascinating. Maybe Shabbat has two different dimensions, and it's not a shift in repetition. It's a shift in focus. Shabbat is a positive thing and a negative thing, and it comes at the end, sometimes at the beginning, at others. Let me ask you all a question. Imagine you are, anybody seen, what's that Tom Hanks movie when he gets lost on an island?
Castaway.
Castaway.
Castaway. Castaway. So imagine you are Tom Hanks. I've just been told my internet connection is unstable. I don't know what that means.
Much clearer now, though.
It is clearer?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, the Malbim never right. had that problem.
He never had a few problems.
He did it. You mentioned the Malbim, Michael, and he froze.
The Malbim broke the internet.
Or he disappeared.
Just put a little scotch on it.
Where's the Malbim?
You're back, Rabbi.
I'm back. Okay.
I think we should get one of those Chabad cars. He can drive around the neighborhood broadcasting his shir.
That's crazy. That's crazy. I use Bag to Jerusalem, Bag to They're very convenient. I mean, some people are phone so much. I don't care.
Daddy's on the phone. What?
Okay. My grand
is the stickers. It's fishes in this.
It's on
Does anybody see him?
I guess there are fishes.
No.
Oh, there's
nobody sees him.
He just doesn't look like this.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh. Here you are. Here you are.
We lost you.
I'm there.
Okay. Yes, Rabbi, we hear you.
Rabbi, you may want to mute everyone else, Rabbi.
Okay. I've muted you all. You can unmute yourself if you need. Mark, give me a thumbs up. I can see you if you can hear me. Okay, great. So we asked the question, why Shabbat is first now in Parashat Vayakel? And actually, the Baal HaTorim has a fascinating reading where he suggests that it's a necessity because of what happened at the end of last week's parasha. Last week's parasha, Moshe comes down from Har Sinai with the second set of luchot, and he is literally glowing. His face is radiant from the experience. Last week we asked the question, why his face glowed after the second set, but not after the first. And there were all sorts of suggestions as to why that's the case, but the Baal HaTorim says it's flowing on from that radiance on Moshe's face that actually leads him to speak about Shabbos almost without helping it, because Shabbos is what provides radiance to us. It is that peace. It is that central island of harmony. And again, and I don't want to harp on it, but in the current situation, I know that many are anxious about the possibility of a hollow day, of a Shabbos without shul. On some level, the break from technology, I think, will be healthy for many of us who are getting streams of updates and headlines and WhatsApps. If I look away from WhatsApp for 10 minutes, I come back and there are 50 messages there from rabbinic groups and everything else. And actually, Shabbos is an island at which a sense of calm and radiance can flow. And that is a Baal HaTorim suggestion as to why Shabbos comes right at the beginning of this week's parasha, flowing off from last week's radiance of Moshe's face. But there is another reading which brings us to Tom Hanks' Castaway. Morty Brandwine has his hand up. Do you have a question? You're just waving? Okay. So I asked you if you were Tom Hanks and you were cast away and you had no idea what day of the week it was, and you had no calendar and you had no phone and you had no contact and no means of finding out the date, when would you keep Shabbos? And I invite you to unmute yourself and give me an answer. When would you keep Shabbos?
Tom Hanks isn't Jewish, so he wouldn't.
Tom Hanks is Jewish because all Hollywood actors are Jewish, but could try. Let's say
pick a day, make that Sunday, and count from there.
Pick a day, meaning right then, or just pick, when pick, it can be.
Say today is Sunday, and then count through 7 days, and that's Shabbos.
Interesting. And in your theory, you could say, I want 3 days' time to be Sunday and go from there, meaning it's up to you.
It's the only way to do it.
Stop from the known day.
Establish a baseline.
You've got to establish a baseline. Right. So it's interesting. This is actually a matter of debate in the Gemara of Shabbos. And the Gemara of Shabbos, as always, it's a debate. There is one view that today is Sunday and you count 6 days and then you keep Shabbos. And there's another view that right now is Shabbos. Today, the day one is Shabbos, and then you go from there and you go forward. And the fundamental question is why you would pick one over the other. And if I were to ask you intuitively, should Shabbos be day one or day seven, what would you say?
Well, don't you need time to prepare for Shabbos? If you make Shabbos, how's your wife going to cook?
Yeah, you'll be grateful to be cast away.
I'm not on the island.
Right, she's not cooking for you, that's true. So I guess intuitively you're right, maybe you'd want it to have a little bit of time to prepare. So even the first view doesn't say the moment you wake up, that's Shabbos, but it means the first full day is Shabbos, and then you go from there in terms of prioritizing. So intuitively, if I were to ask you, is Shabbos day one or is Shabbos day seven, what would you pick? And give me a reason other than you need...
Maaseh Bereishis, day seven.
That seems intuitively to make sense to me as well. If I say to you, what day is Shabbos? You would say it's the seventh day of the week. So tomorrow's Sunday and I'll go from there. And that's a powerful claim made by Rav Huna in the Gemara. Shabbos is the seventh day.
But whenever we count... Whenever we count, don't we always say we count from one to seven, just like for the Omer, Sheva Shabbosot, however, we start with one. Yes, yeah, the view is going 50 and down, but setting that aside, we're starting at one, and we're counting to seven, then we count 7 weeks and get to Shabbos.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Shabbos, you're reinforcing the point, is the seventh day, right?
Yes, yes.
And it's astonishing that there is a view that it should be day one. But actually, when you think about it a little more, it becomes quite powerful that you're right in terms of creation, Shabbos is day seven. But who wasn't there on day one of creation? Let's start, who was there?
Adam wasn't there.
Man wasn't.
There was no human being. Woman. There was no woman there either. Yes, you're right.
No cooking.
Okay, we're going to have to get ourselves out of that hole pretty quick. So
not you, me.
But
you have the muting power. So.
That's true. But I don't have the technological power, so we're stuck. So let's put it this way. Day one was Sunday for Kodesh Baruch Hu, for man and woman, for humanity writ large. Shabbos was day one. They were born on Friday and they went into Shabbos. So the other position in the Gemara says, you're right, from the angle of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, Shabbos is the end of the week. From the angle of humanity, it's actually the first day. Human beings didn't experience Sunday before Shabbos. The first full day that human beings ever experienced was a day of rest, was a day of Shabbos. And you would have thought that humanity would have been born and forged to make and toil and work and labor, but actually they were born and killed and given Shabbos. And Shabbos is this powerful inflection point where it is not a conclusion and it is not a beginning, but it is actually at the nexus of 1 week to the next and a pivot point where we are to recharge, refresh, rejuvenate to lead in to the next week. And that, it is claimed, Rabbi Sacks has a piece at one place and a number of other figures that suggests that's precisely why in the first reading of the Mishkan Shabbat is at the end and the second Shabbat is at the beginning. Because Shabbat is not always the end. We often view it in that sense, but it's also the beginning of the week to come. It's an inflection point, and that's why Shabbat appears right at the very beginning. Now, there's another bit as we keep going through the parsha. We haven't got to the pasuk we put under pressure yet. We'll get there. I've no idea what the time is. We have 20 minutes. So we'll get there. All right, we won't. Fine, we won't. We'll try. As you get further through the parasha, as they are accounting for all the contributions that everybody gave, there is an oddity in the description. Moshe reports to the people everything that everybody gave, and he says as follows. V'yitzav Moshe v'yavru kol b'machana le'mor. Moses commanded, this is Lamed Vav Vav, and a voice went through the camp, Ish v'isha al ya'asu ot melacha l'trumat ha'kodesh. Nobody should give any more contributions. Never since that time in history has a rabbi uttered those words. You've given enough. Moshe says, stop. V'yikale ha'am mehavi, and the people stop from bringing. Why? V'amalacha heita dayam. Because the work was dayam. What does dayam mean?
Enough.
Enough. We'll get to dayenu, please God, in short order. V'amlacha heita dayam. It was enough. V'hoter, and hoter means, and it was extra. And a number of the commentaries wonder how in the very same verse, Moses can report to the people that it was enough and it was too much. Does anybody share that concern, or do people have an easy solution? Yep. Well, the straightforward solution is, it's not a contradiction. It was enough, and it was too much. Too much is also enough. They gave enough. Oh, Terry, not only did they give enough, it was more, meaning people were so eager to contribute there were leftovers. And that's exactly what Nachmanides says. That's what Ramban says. So you're in good company if you were thinking about that. However, there are other views. Say again. Okay. There are other views that suggest actually there is meaning in this excess. When Moshe says it was enough and there was too much, there is a tension there. And the Sforno suggests that actually they gave enough that the excess was used for luxurious exuberance, because it would have been enough just to have the basic kalim, but people gave enough in order to make it more artistic, more aesthetically attractive, more ornate. That is the view of the Sforno. The Emek Dava, the Netziv, actually says they gave enough that there was they could throw things away, which is astonishing. Again, in an age when we seek our best not to waste and to preserve as much as we can, the Emek Dava Netziv suggests that they gave so much material that the carvings and the shavings and the cuttings could be thrown out and didn't need to be repurposed, which again is an aesthetic blessing that the Mishkan was not in a position where it had to recycle and repurpose relics and residual waste in order to make itself. But the final reading of this I want to share before we turn to our pasuk under pressure, which is the Or HaChaim, the mystic of Aleppo, I've mentioned a number of times. And he says as follows. Dayam means it was enough. Hoter mein, they gave too much. And he suggests that actually, at root, people gave way too much for use in the Mishkan. And if somebody gives too much, what does one think one should do with the money? I'll ask you now, those of you who are treasurers, if you get too much income, what do you do with it?
Save it.
So you save it. That's the Nachmanidean mind. Save it. If it is a non-profit and you've said we need to meet a certain target and you meet that target and people pledge and overpledge and overpledge and you've met your target and you don't have any expenditures, what do you do with the money?
Give it away.
Be kiddish.
Kiddish. Okay, you could do a kiddish. Give it a or you could...
It's your cushion.
Okay, so we've got a lot of accountants
here
planning, and you're all good planners. In theory, the Or HaChaim says, if you make an appeal for a particular cause and you meet your target, it's only fair that if you've told people, I need money for this particular purpose, and the purpose is fulfilled, that you give it back. You're right. When we make appeals, generally, the assumption is it's going to go to a good cause. And if it doesn't go to this particular cause, because their need is met or they collapse, it'll go to another good cause. But if I ask everybody for money to go to a particular cause and that cause folds, I should give the money back. That's only fair if people gave it with that intention. And the Aruch Chaim says that actually there was a miracle here. People gave too much, and Moshe was on the bridge of saying, I need to give some of this back. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, what's going to happen to the psychological dynamic of the Jewish people if their contributions are returned? And I'll take your suggestion.
They will have felt rejected.
There will be a large group of people who feel, number one, they feel rejected. Feel like I stood up to the plate and the money didn't get used. What are they likely not to do in the future?
They will not give any more again.
So number one, we've got, they're going to feel dejected. And you're going to have a whole spread of people who feel like they've been rejected by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're going to have a spread of people who aren't going to contribute again. And most centrally for the Aruch Chaim,
they might not believe you.
Say again?
They might not believe you the next time.
Well, that's possible. My instinct would be that actually your credibility is quite solid because you gave it back and said we didn't need to use it. And they're going to say, okay, well, this guy's honest. Otherwise, he would have taken it and pocketed it. My sense from the Aruch Chaim is the key problem here, the necessity for a miracle, was that there would be people who would feel we don't have a part in this community. We don't have a role to play. It's not just that I feel rejected because they gave it back, but my neighbors contributed. I can see that brick. I can see that plank. I can see that metal plate. And I know that somebody gave that and feels that they have a role at the epicenter of our spiritual life. And I've got no stake. I've got no role. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu somehow condensed all the material so that the hoter became dayam, so that every excess became just enough. It contracted. And while you would have thought instinctively again, as somebody whose father-in-law is an accountant, as someone who's doing their taxes as we speak, not as we speak, but afterwards, I would want to save every dime. I'd want them to send it back. So you're not going to use it? Fine, I'll take it. But the psychological stakes of people not having a role to play and not feeling like they have stakes in the spiritual welfare and edifice of the community was so high that HaKadosh Baruch Hu contracted all the contributions so that it would fit and be enough and everybody had a role to play. That's the assumption based on that pasuk, that the contributions were too much, but also they were enough. Now, we are going to start progressing towards our pasuk under pressure.
And you are not.
Say again?
I said, I'm still waiting for you to get to that pasuk.
I'm getting there. Don't you worry. We're so close. In fact, I was going to share the screen with you, but I can't do that now because I'm on my phone and it wasn't working on the machine, on the computer. So what I'll do is you're going to have to be spared the graphic. I'm just going to have to read it to you, I'm afraid. How many things are we not allowed to do on Shabbat?
You could. I mean, Rabbi, if you email,
they could share it.
Say again. Oh, if I email you the sheet. All right. Well, we'll see if that happens in the meantime. How many malachot are there on Shabbos?
39 av malachot.
39 that we can't do. How many are mentioned in the Torah?
None.
One.
I'd say you're all right. Because one of you said one, which is correct. One of you said none, which is incorrect. But in the spirit of contraction, I'm going to squeeze that beginning end and take the one at the end. Yes, there is only one prohibition listed in the Torah when it comes to Shabbat. And
fire.
There are other instances when there is a debate. There is a figure in later on who carries wood and gathers wood and is put to death, and there's a debate about what he did. Okay. Say again?
I was saying, look.
Some sarcastic joke, probably about cooking again. So That is exactly what this malache is, esh, which is cooking. It's the only one that's mentioned. And it's mentioned in this week's parsha, where Moshe gathers all the people and he tells them not to do work on Shabbos. Lo tavaru esh b'chol moshvatechem b'yom ha-Shabbos. And you shouldn't light a fire anywhere on Shabbos. And does anybody know any controversies that arose as a result of this pasuk? There should be no fire on Shabbos.
The prohibition of using electricity by the rabbis.
Oh, okay. So we're diving right in. That was actually, it is planned to be my one of the special pre-mincha shirim in the Omer Shabbatot. We may have to adapt that to a weeknight shir. The status of electricity on Shabbos is complicated. And it does start with the malacha of Esh. Now, how many of you have hit a switch and imagine that fire goes running there in the house? If you imagine that, it's because we were probably all taught that at one point. It happens not to be the truth, scientifically speaking, but it is true. Electricity was initially banned by one of the late great rabbinic sages of Israel on the basis that he thought it was a biblically prohibited act of lighting a fire. Anyone know who said that?
The Malbim?
Obviously, because he said everything important. No, unfortunately, it was not the Malbim. They didn't quite have electricity full running when he was around. It was the Chazon Ish. And what happened since that statement was made is a long story for our attention after Pesach. But Lotavaru Eish actually stemmed the controversy far before electricity arose in the age of the Karaites. The Karaites were a group, a sect of Jews who believed that there is no old tradition and the biblical text has to be taken literally. And Lotavaru Eish, you shall not have a fire lit, means there shall be no fire, there shall be no light, there shall be no hot food. And actually, in the medieval period, it was a test of your Jewish faith and credentials whether you ate chulin. Because if you were not willing to have hot food on Shabbos, people doubted whether you had strict belief or whether you had the heresy. And it wasn't just you didn't like chulin, but you took that pasuk, lo tavaru esh b'chol moshvatechem, that you shouldn't have a fire anywhere on Shabbos, meaning you can't reheat. And the rabbinic tradition is thrown aside. It was seen as a heretical stance. And lo tavaru esh just means you can't light a fire on Shabbos. But a fire can be there on Shabbos. We have hot plates and all sorts of things that reheat on Shabbos. There was actually an interesting halachic question raised about lighting candles. This is discussed by the medieval commentators. You light candles Friday night and they burn through on Shabbos. Why are you not held responsible for that act? And that's a side halachic point. But this is a question I'll pose to you in the time that remains, in the last 6 minutes. If I were to pick, of all the 39 malachot, and I asked you to pick one to put in the Torah as the prototypical, archetypal, representative, prohibited labor, why would you pick fire? Why would that be the one that is listed?
You cook on Shabbos.
Interesting. Maybe it's the most prevalent, that people don't go around shechting all the time. People don't always need to knead or sow or harvest all the time. But cooking is something that takes place all the time in the home. It's not just an agricultural act. So maybe it's more knitted in with everybody's daily life. Interesting. Any other suggestions?
Maybe it has something to do with the destructive power of fire.
Go on.
That Shabbos is a time when we're celebrating creation and not destruction.
Fascinating. Actually, there is a, I don't have it on the sheet that I would have shared with you, but there is a mystical tradition that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a pact with the Jewish people and said that here's his pact. I will stop burning the fires of Gehenna on Shabbos and you will stop burning the fires of earth at the same time. And it is seen precisely in that light as a destructive force. And that we spare the world the damage of fire as a Kodesh Baruch who spares the souls in the afterworld of the damage of fire there. In fact, there are all sorts of mystical traditions that have arisen and actually have woven their way into something that we all do every week on Shabbos, probably without knowing the mystical connection, which is the assumption that the fires of Gehenna stop on Shabbos and they restart when Shabbos is gone. Anybody know any minhagim at Sudah Shlishit that are connected to the fact that the fires are about to restart?
Ms. Mardu.
I heard people do Sudah Shlishit in the dark.
Right. Okay, fascinating. We tend not to do Sudah Shlishit in the dark, that's true.
There are people that specifically do it in the dark.
There are people who do it in the dark?
Yeah.
I've seen that.
Eish Kodesh.
The time switch went off, or they did it on purpose?
They do it every Shabbos on purpose.
I have no idea. Interesting. I'll have to. You'll have to fill me in on that. Something that we all do, or we all try or tend to do, is to sing Mizmor LeDavid, and we sing it three times. The Lord is with me, and I shall not want. It is an elegy. It is almost a hymn of loss because we are preparing for the fact that the gates of hell are about to restart. There is also a minhag actually not to drink any water in after mincha on Shabbos, any fresh water, because that's taking water away from the souls who are on their reprieve from the fires of hell. Again, this is in a realm of mystical thinking that I'm not an expert in. But it's just a fascinating backdrop to all these traditions that have arisen around that. That's the same reason we say Sidkatcha after Shabbos Mincha, because it is a statement that we are recognizing God's power despite the loss that's about to come.
And that's also the reason we don't drink the Mayim Achronim.
We definitely don't drink the Mayim Achronim, although I have seen you trying to take a few sips, Ellie.
Rabbi, your question regarding the Eish, could it have to do with the fact that Motzei Shabbos, you know, Havdalah, and that's when Adam discovered Eish?
Fascinating. I can't see you, but I think that was Jerry.
Yes, it was.
Excellent. So on the sheet that I've not shared with you, that is precisely what Rabbeinu Bachya says. He doesn't couch it in so much mystical or historical narrative terms, but he says there's one good reason why Eish is the archetypal Malacha, and he puts it in these terms. Ha'Eish sibatam v'ikaram kol malachot. Eish is the starting point of every Malacha. Without fire, you cannot make implements, you cannot cook, you cannot make dye, you cannot make a knife to do shechita. Nothing can get off the ground in terms of human labor without fire. And that's why it's listed, because it is the most encompassing of everything. If I were to say, pick one malacha, and you said shechita, what else does that imply? Maybe bishul, maybe you shouldn't cook. It's hard to extrapolate other than one, which is Eish. Once you have Eish on the page, you know that nothing involving human labor can be done. And he says that is precisely the way on Motzei Shabbos we light a fire. L'fisha ha'Eish tchilat malachot. It's basically the way it's these a starter gun. Of the race to work during the week, we light a fire to say, okay, labor can begin again. So that's exactly the way Rabbeinu Bachya captures it. The Chizkuni, interestingly enough, has the opposite view. And he says, Eish is included. No, I see that it's time for Marv in 1 second. If people are joining, we'll be wrapping up momentarily. The Rabbeinu Bachya says, Eish is the most representative of all the malachot. And the Chizkuni says it is the least representative. Every other malacha has something in common. There are materials that exist, and we are exerting labor to change them. When we die, we are shifting color from one state to the next. When we knead, we are taking ingredients and we're pushing them together. When we cook, we are taking ingredients that are raw and we're manipulating their state. When it comes to fire, it's not dependent on us. There is this spark that is almost magical, and it doesn't seem like work or labor or human effort. It seems almost celestial. And fire needs to be listed, not because it represents everything else, but because when it says, you shan't do kol melacha, everything else would have been intuitive, but fire would not have. So fire needs to be listed. But I'm going to finish with a final thought noted by the Kli Akar and others, which connects to the point about fire being destructive. Lo tuvaru eish, you shall not ignite a fire on Shabbos, is considered by many to relate not to purely the chemical term, but also in metaphor. You shall not ignite a fire on Shabbos. What kind of fire is that, Jerry? The fire of anger. And I mentioned that not because Jerry gets particularly angry, but because I mentioned this actually in the Hashkama Minyan when I came to try out last year. And I thought maybe a year later, we'll see. So
you remember it.
Say again?
That somebody would remember it. You can make this. You can make the same drusha next year.
Now that I know, that's good.
I was new. I couldn't say anything.
So, were you saying it?
Nah, not really.
Yeah, good try. So, the Kliyakar and others, based on the Zohar and a mystical reading, say that Lo Tavaru Esh B'Yom HaShabbos is not just about the Malacha, but it is a double innuendo, that we should not become angry on Shabbos. And the question posed by all the commentators is, well, hold on a minute, are you saying that Sunday through Friday I should be angry? And Shabbos, I shouldn't. Why is Shabbos the only time when we shouldn't be angry? And what's the answer? So I'll tell you what the Kliyakar says. And actually, again, was that a suggestion?
Shabbos Menucha.
Okay, so Shabbos, you especially want to avoid anger because it's not in the spirit of the day. So there is actually
maybe Shabbos sets the tone for the rest of the week.
Fascinating. So on Shabbos, you are actually, this pivots to the point with which we began, that Shabbos is not just the end, it is also a beginning. And the way that we set the tone right now has us aiming to go forward. That's a fascinating option. So the Kliyakar actually says something interesting, which I heard somebody repurpose earlier this week, again, to our current circumstance. The Kliyakar says, you're right, Shabbos is a spiritual day. It's a sacred day. It's a day of reflection and engagement. But actually, sometimes it can be a day when we're just not doing anything. And when we're not doing anything and we're cooped up with our families together, that is when often irritation, frustration, and lack of patience can arise. And during the week, we're all so busy, the Kliyakar says, that it's hard to have time to get angry or irritated because you're running from one thing to the next and you don't have time to think. And then Shabbos comes, and you're sitting at a table, and your spouse or your child is eating with their mouth open, or breathing loudly, or blowing their nose, and then somebody's not listening, and somebody didn't clean this dish, and I'm sitting here, I want to relax, it's a Shabbos, and somebody didn't tidy this up. And it's actually because we aren't working, because we aren't driven from one thing to the next, it can be particularly easy to slip into unnecessary impatience and rage. And the warning here is not just because, oh, Shabbos is higher than other days and we need to be more careful, but actually Shabbos, we're more likely to get angry because we are not working. And the warning is, even though you're not busy, even though you're cooped up together inside, one should try extra hard to have extra patience and extra calm and count to 10 and think before one speaks. And I heard, as I mentioned, this repurposed early in the week, that this is the time when many of us are not going to have outside contact with many people. This is as close as many of us will get unless we're passing on the street. And when we get home, we are more likely to suffer from impatience and frustration. I was on a call earlier. Dr. Pelkovitz was online with a number of rabbis, and he was making this point as well, that we all can have a lower threshold for impatience when we are cooped up, when we feel some of us have got more busy because of the current situation and some of us have got less busy. And being less busy can be a dream and a fantasy for those of us who are more busy, but actually it comes with its own burdens. And being less busy opens up the possibility of lower thresholds to impatience and frustration and feeling a sense of aimlessness. And we're told, Lo Tavaru Esh B'Yom HaShabbos, we should try not to be angry. We should try to be as calm as we can. And you, Shabbos, as you've mentioned, as that pivot point, not that it's an end. We haven't reached the black hole from which there is no escape, but this is the launch pad for us to take our power, our passions, our energy to focus for the week to come.